This is episode 316 of That Shakespeare Life. Just like the work of William Shakespeare, That Shakespeare Life is powered by our patrons. Listeners just like you can sign up to support our work on Patreon right now at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. And stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Jared Brown.
I'm Anastasia Miller.
We're historians of drink. You can find us at sipsmith.com and at mixellany, mixellany.com.
Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this.
It's That Shakespeare Life with our friend, Cassidy Cash.
Anne Hathaway's was one of those voices that wasn't foregrounded in literature, because it was always as the wife of William Shakespeare. And there's a bio in the back of the book where we list the contributors' biographies. And my favourite one is William Shakespeare's, because it says, William Shakespeare was a poet and playwright and the husband of Anne Hathaway. And that, for me, symbolised exactly why I think Anne deserved to be put on a platform and given her chance to shine.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Before William Shakespeare was the great playwright of his age, he was just Will from Stratford-upon-Avon. The one person in the world who not only loved him before he was famous, but walked beside him for the entire journey from young man with nothing but relentless optimism to successful playwright patronized by the monarchy of England was his wife, Anne Hathaway. Anne married William in 1582, and by the time Shakespeare was skyrocketing to fame in the 1590s with plays like the Henry VI series, Two Gentlemen of Verona, and Romeo and Juliet, the couple were parents to three children, including one set of twins. In honor of the person who quite literally kept the home fires burning so that the man who conquered the world with his work would have somewhere and someone to come home to, our guests this week have compiled a poetic tribute to Anne Hathaway called The Anthology. The collection features poetry and sonnets by modern scholars of Anne Hathaway, as well as a few written by Anne's children. In our first ever group interview here on That Shakespeare Life, we are pleased to welcome our friends Chris Lautaris, Catherine Shile, Aaron Kent, and Paul Edmondson to the show to tell us more about Anne Hathaway and the making of this memorial poetry collection. Aaron Kent is the founder director of Broken Sleep Books, an incredible award-winning publisher who does a lot of community and charity work and one of the most powerful vehicles in poetry and creative writing for the diversification of authorial voices in the literary field. All the funds from the sale of Anthology go to Paul Edmondson's institution, the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, which is a registered charity with the aim of using those funds for children's education initiatives, which the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust does so well, reaching thousands of school children, not just around the UK, but across the globe. Paul Edmondson has been the face of Shakespeare Birthplace Trust for many years and has spearheaded so many of its pioneering initiatives. Catherine Shile is professor and expert in Anne Shakespeare, the world authority, in fact, and she is based at the University of Minnesota. Her groundbreaking research has revolutionized Anne Shakespeare studies. Chris Lautaris is a Shakespeare scholar, biographer, and historian whose specialties include the history of Shakespeare's theaters, Renaissance politics, and the history of death, burial, and commemoration, among others. Find more about each of our guests this week, including links to their work and previous episodes with a couple of these guests, right here on That Shakespeare Life, as well as links to this collection of poetry dedicated to Anne Shakespeare herself, titled Anthology, all packed into the show notes for today's episode. Hello to all of you. Welcome to That Shakespeare Life. As we are a group here today, and that's a new dynamic for our show, I would like for you to say hello and state your name so our listeners can recognize your voice during our conversation today.
Hello, I'm Paul.
Hello, I'm Catherine.
Hello, I'm Chris.
Hello, I'm Aaron.
We are so glad to have each of you here to share some history about Anne Hathaway, the wife of William Shakespeare. I know this project was a labor of love for each of you, but I wondered what spawned the project initially. Chris, tell us about the inspiration behind this collection. What motivated you to put this poetry collection together?
Sure. Thank you so much, Cassidy. As I'm sure you will have heard, 2023 marked the 400th anniversary of the first folio, the first edition of Shakespeare's collected plays published in 1623. This happened to be the very year in which Anne Shakespeare died. We put together this anthology because we felt Anne deserved a book of her own, a book which challenged some of the stereotypes and assumptions attached to her name. We wanted to set Anne free from the restrictions of being simply Shakespeare's wife, or even worse, Shakespeare's mistake, who he felt compelled to marry. And we didn't want the quarter centenary of Anne's death to pass by in silence, to be elided in favour of the so memorialisation of her more famous dramatist husband. Instead, we placed her centre stage, celebrating her memory while engaging with the ways in which her lost agency could be reclaimed. There's no better publisher for this than Aaron Kent and the award-winning Broken Sleep Books, a socially conscious publisher committed to diversifying voices in the arts and creative sectors. So what we did was include poems about Anne, gathered expertly by Catherine, which were published in History. In addition to this, we commissioned 67 new creative responses, one for every year of Anne's life. And when we sent out a call for these poems, we asked some pretty provocative questions, you know, like, was Anne a writer, a poet, or storyteller? How did she cope with her son Hamnet's tragic early death? How might she have reacted to the prejudices attached to women's social roles? How did she articulate her own gender or sexual identity? Did she navigate her world with a non-normative body or with a neuroatypical outlook? And what might her voice sound like if she were to speak through a different set of ethnic or religious influences to those traditionally accorded to her? So we wanted this volume to interface not only with who Anne was or what she might have meant to past generations, but with what she represents for us today. And so we were so thrilled with the response we got. Some incredible poems giving us a kaleidoscope of new Annes, reflecting today's broad variety of female identifying perspectives, social identities, sexualities, ethnic backgrounds, and national and regional affiliations, as well as drawing on the richness of responses from neuro and physically diverse creative communities. But we also wanted to engage in this book with the possibilities for appropriating and owning the past, and the terms we use to do this, which we are bequeathing to future generations. And this is why we were keen to include children in the volume two. And we're so grateful to the staff at Holy Trinity Church School for facilitating the contribution of 6 Year 5 pupils, arranged by Paul, who provided inspiring and moving poems for this collection. Because how we interpret history's influential figures, we believe, and how we involve our younger members of society in those conversations really does matter. Every time we represent the image of Anne, what we are really doing is seeing ourselves. And this is why all the proceeds from this book go to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust to help support their education initiatives. And we're grateful to Dame Janet Sussman for writing a fantastic foreword for the book, and also to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust for their support with the project.
These sound adorable. I'm so excited about the inclusion of the children's voices. Those are really beautiful, and what a great piece to put in there. Aaron, as the director and founder of Broken Sleep Books, what was most appealing to you about publishing this poetic collection about Anne Hathaway?
Well, I think with Broken Sleep Books, my whole aim was to run a publishing press that put underrepresented voices at the forefront and platform those voices. And that came through initially that as a working class writer, I didn't see my voice in literature. But then as you move through and you do that, there's so many different voices. And Anne Hathaway's was one of those voices that wasn't foregrounded in literature, because it was always as the wife of William Shakespeare. And there's a bio in the back of the book where we list the contributors' biographies. And my favorite one is William Shakespeare's, because it says William Shakespeare was a poet and playwright and the husband of Anne Hathaway. And that for me symbolized exactly why I think Anne deserved to be put on a platform and given her chance to shine, because so long it's been the vice versa. And, you know, there's poems in there that talk about the importance of what Anne did for William that allowed him to be the playwright he was. I taught William Shakespeare at GCSE and A-level, which is, I don't know what sort of region that would be in America, but that's like secondary school over here, so like 12 to 16 years old, and then taught it again at 17, 18 years old. And the thing I always realized was so many students instantly went, ugh, Shakespeare, oh no, blah, 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 because they just saw the text. And I realized the way to teach Shakespeare was to teach the impact of Shakespeare, but also the life around Shakespeare. And it was surprising how many students you could get into Shakespeare if they knew about Anne Shakespeare, if they knew about Hamlet, if they knew about the world around him rather than just the text that he presented. And that's why I thought it was so important.
We certainly support that perspective here.
100%. Exactly. And I think that's the main thing, isn't it? Is to say, okay, these texts are one thing, but there's a whole world behind them. And by just exploring the texts and William Shakespeare, we're missing so much of that world, so much of that beauty and that glory and all the stuff and the intricacies and the nature of the world around it and everything. And when my wife and I went to Stratford-upon-Avon to read from this book on the 400th anniversary of Anne Shakespeare's death, I remember going into the cottage and being wowed, and not wowed anything to do with William. That wasn't what was wowing me. What was wowing me was Anne's presence in that cottage. And that was why it was important, I felt, to publish this book.
The anthology poetry collection describes itself as reflective of Anne Shakespeare's identity, which begs the question, how do you get to know her identity? Where does one start to get to know a historical figure personally? What can you tell us about what went into getting to know her?
The first place to start with Anne as a person is the epitaph on her grave in Holy Trinity Church in Stratford-on-Avon, which is the most reliable piece of evidence about her. So it's engraved on a brass plate, and her family paid for a burial on the chancel steps. So both of those aspects, the brass plate and the chancel burial, would have entailed a substantial financial investment on the part of Anne's family. Her epitaph was also produced by one of the top engravers of the day, who also did the monument to Michael Drayton in Westminster Abbey and became Master Mason to the Crown. So her epitaph that commemorates her life shows that she was a beloved mother, a member of her family, and that her survivors wanted to memorialize her in a significant way. The content of the epitaph as well is also really important for giving us a sense of the real Anne. It dates from just after her death, probably from the late 1620s, and it has a beautiful Latin poem written from a child to a mother describing Anne as a pious woman and so great a gift. I should say something about the infamous second best bed bequest to Anne in Shakespeare's will. The very famous biographers have used this as a way to denigrate her as a disastrous mistake, as one biographer puts it. But Lena Orland's work has shown that the second best bed was not an insult, and that plenty of wills from the period included second best, third best, fourth best, and even fifth best beds as terms of endearment rather than insult. So I hope we can put the second best bed to rest.
Put it to bed, as we say. Had to throw that in there.
Put it to bed permanently as a piece of evidence about Anne's life, because it just doesn't hold up. So, but I think the epitaph on her grave, produced just after her death by her family, by people who knew her and thought about how to memorialize her, that's really the best place to find the real Anne.
So what do we know about Anne Hathaway and William Shakespeare's courtship and marriage? One of my favorite items when I visited Stratford-upon-Avon was seeing what's known as the wooing chair there at Anne Hathaway's cottage. And I remember leaving, not being sure whether that was real or not. Was this something that William actually would have wooed Anne using this chair? And what do we actually know about their personal relationship? Were they in love with each other?
Well, first of all, the chair's been much on my mind recently, because a courting chair is about to be appearing in an exhibition which the Birthplace Trust is curating in New Place. And we have at least two courting chairs in our collection. Now, the one that you saw and that Aaron and his wife saw and that we've all seen at Anne Hathaway's cottage has the initials WAS carved into the back of it. It is a chair of the period. It was spotted in the 1790s by Samuel Island, who bought the chair from the cottage. The Birthplace Trust bought the chair back to the cottage in about 2002. We were pleased to get it back into the cottage after all that time. But somewhere between Samuel Island acquiring it and it coming back to the Birthplace Trust, those initials, we think, were engraved on it. But it was probably a chair from New Place originally, which ended up in Anne Hathaway's cottage. So, you know, we can assume that it has maybe some Shakespearean association. How a courting chair worked is anybody's guess, because if one person's sitting on the chair, there isn't any room for another person to sit on the chair unless you sat on the person's lap who was already sitting on the chair. There is a courting settle at Anne Hathaway's cottage, which is much more like a bench, and guides over the century and a half of Anne Hathaway's cottage being presented to the public, and perhaps before then as well, when the family were presenting it to visitors. I'd like to say, well, this is the courting settle. This is where they, as it were, snuggled up when William would walk from Stratford-upon-Avon, or perhaps he went on horseback, to Shottery, which is only a mile and a half away. We wish we knew more about their courtship. There is a sonnet, which is in anthology, Sonnet 145, which is sometimes referred to as the Hathaway Sonnet. That's because the final couplet puns on her surname, Hathaway, with the phrase hate away, and reads, I hate from hate away she threw, and save my life, saying, not you. So the sonnet, which is perhaps about rejection, turns in that couplet, and the rejected lover feels called back by the beloved, saying, I don't hate you anymore. And hate away was an alternative pronunciation of Hathaway in Shakespeare's period. They had three children, Susanna, and then twins, Hamlet and Judith. Susanna born 1583, Hamlet and Judith born 1585, and then no more children followed. And this has been one of the facts that have led people to say, oh, well, it wasn't a happy marriage. Shakespeare was away a lot of the time. Well, you know, supposing she couldn't have any more children after having given birth to the twins, supposing that was a very difficult birth with complications, it doesn't mean to say they weren't intimate as husband and wife since the birth of the twins. But one looks across, you see it, large families all over the country at that time, including Stratford-upon-Avon, contemporaries of Shakespeare's, with 11, 12, 13, 14 children. So only to have three does look unusual. We should note that they seem to be very much in love when they first got married, because they had to. She was already 3 months pregnant when they got married by special license towards the end of 1582. William was only 18. Which was very unusual. The average age for men to marry in Stratford-upon-Avon between 1570 and 1630 was 26. And in that period, only three men got married under the age of 20. And of those three, Shakespeare was the youngest and the only one whose wife was already pregnant before they got married. And of the 393 marriages in that period, 54 had pregnancy before marriage. So it wasn't uncommon, but it was unusual that he was so young, and it rather ruined his chances, because you couldn't be married and an apprentice. That wasn't allowed. So the usual way of going into life and finding a trade was ruined by Shakespeare's early marriage. You know, it would have been something of a that people locally really noticed at the time. So, but, you know, there we are. That's just quite a bit about the early life together, and perhaps even a sonnet written about her.
When William Shakespeare's fame grew and he was working in London as a successful playwright, apparently overcoming quite significant social obstacles to do that, why didn't Anne Hathaway move to the city with her husband? Was it typical of the period for a couple to have a split dynamic of the husband working in one city and the wife and family living in a different one?
One way to think about this question is to ask why Shakespeare moved away from his family in Stratford, and what role Anne may have played in that arrangement. So with the exception of Shakespeare's younger brother, Edmund, who's described as a player on his grave in Southwark Cathedral in London, Shakespeare's entire family remained in Stratford, as far as we know, including his three children, his parents, and his siblings. I would have loved to know the conversation between Anne and William about his plans to move to London. You know, especially from Anne's point of view, sure, I'll stay here and take care of our three toddlers and your elderly parents and hang around with your brothers and your sister.
And, yes.
And you go off and write poetry. I mean, there must have been a conversation there. But I think it also must have been an amiable agreement, because Shakespeare always maintained ties to Stratford, buying New Place, for example, with 10 fireplaces and 20 rooms. I mean, is it really logical that Anne would leave that living arrangement to drag her children to London, you know, and probably live in a much smaller place? So Stanley Wells called Shakespeare the first literary computer, and I think that's right. So since that Stratford was the home base, in a way, you can say Anne had a major role in the creation of Shakespeare's plays because she made that possible, you know, by agreeing to stay back home, tend the fires of the home place while Shakespeare was off in London writing his plays. That must have been a supportive role that Anne played in that relationship.
Now, as you mentioned, Anne did stay in Stratford-upon-Avon and was running New Place, which was a significant property to be in charge of. What would her typical day have been like running what was, I believe, the largest house in the borough at this time?
It was, and Catherine's just alluded to the size of it, at least 20 rooms. There would have been the lodgers to look after from 1602. They were Thomas Green and Lettice Green, his wife. He was the minute taker of the corporation meetings, which regularly took place next door but one to New Place. So he was very short commute to work, living where he did. While they were in New Place, they had two children whom they named William and Anne after the Shakespeares, maybe suggesting the Shakespeares were godparents to the Green children. So there were responsibilities beyond Judith, who lived there until her marriage in 1616. And Susanna lived there until 1607 when she married John Hall, the physician. So there were plenty of people to look after. And surely each day, for the many years, she was making malt. Now, malt was an essential part of the Stratford-upon-Avon economy, and a lot of it was sold because you needed it to make beer, which was A, desirable, and B, essential, because the water wasn't safe to drink. So you need different levels of beer. Small beer, because you couldn't drink the water, was very weak in its alcohol content, and then a large amount of alcohol, I suppose, to enjoy down the pub with your friends. But there's an inventory of a list of malt being stored in households in Stratford-upon-Avon that dates from the 4th of February, 1598. And, you know, New Place, the Shakespeares are listed on there as having 80 bushels of malt. Now, that means about 2 tons of malt, which it's been calculated was worth about £25, which is the annual salary of a school teacher of the period. So an enormous amount of malt. It's been suggested that with that amount of malt, you could make 600 gallons of ordinary beer and 600 gallons of small beer. So they were clearly dealing in malt and making probably quite a lot of money from it. So Anne was running that business while William was away in London, and even while he was back. There's a record from a local apothecary who owed the money for malt, Philip Rogers, in 1604. So that suggests that they were supplying malt locally. When we had the archaeological dig at New Place, we found evidence of cottage industries such as lace making. So it was an active and busy household. I suppose she was managing servants. There would have been things in the garden to oversee, vegetables and maybe some livestock at the back of New Place, things to acquire from the town each day, neighbours to see, letters to either dictate or to write yourself, and people to communicate with. She was maybe receiving things from London by the carrier, William Greenway, who regularly took his pack horse between Stratford and London and brought things to and from both places. So I think, you know, she had plenty to be doing while William was away in London. And of course, when he came back, whenever he did come back a few times a year, perhaps, or whenever there was plague outbreaks in London, he'd have taken refuge in Stratford-upon-Avon. He had to be looked after and celebrated and made much of, I dare say.
In this collection, you identify Anne Shakespeare's epitaph as being written by both daughters, Susanna and Judith. A lot of scholars have historically attributed this epitaph to Susanna's husband, John Hall, or even sometimes to some other unknown male author. Can you tell us more about Anne's death and why your research attributed her epitaph to her daughters?
Well, we know from Anne's epitaph that she was 67 when she died on August 6th of 1623. We also know that the epitaph is written from the point of view of a child to a mother. So it's a very personal statement. Both of Anne's daughters, Susanna and Judith, were mothers at the time of Anne's death. And the epitaph is basically a eulogy to motherhood. And it's placed right between Shakespeare's grave and his monument on the wall of the church. So I like to think that Susanna and Judith took great pleasure in doing this, you know, in saying that motherhood is equally important to the literary achievements of their father. And it would make sense that Susanna and Judith would have written this epitaph to their mother, as opposed to Susanna's husband ventriloquizing for them or some other unknown male figure. Did Shakespeare really not teach his own daughters to read and write? Or Anne, you know, read and write? We don't have any actual evidence of that, but I think lack of evidence isn't negative evidence. It's just absence of evidence. And Laurie McGuire has done some really interesting work recently on Judith Shakespeare and the fact that she signed with a mark or with a little symbol, not necessarily meaning that she wasn't literate, but that there may be other explanations for that. I should say it was a very exciting moment when we decided we are going to list these two women as authors of the epitaph. And I'm pretty sure this is the first time that that's been done, you know, to say that both of these women were authors.
So we don't have any details about exactly how she died, but we can tell a lot about how she lived from how she was memorialized.
Correct. So I think as a beloved mother and even member of the community, so where Anne's grave is on the chancel steps in Holy Trinity Church, the very prominent place, and Anne's burial really sets into place the whole series of Shakespeare family graves. So Shakespeare's, of course, was the first one on the chancel steps, but then Anne's was second, and then following three other members of the Shakespeare family. So it's really the establishment of the Shakespeare family in that prominent place. So the idea that Anne was a disastrous mistake or someone that, you know, was kind of best forgotten, that just doesn't make any sense in terms of the prominent placement of her memorial as a mother and as a beloved family member.
We mentioned earlier that Anne celebrated the 400th anniversary of her death last year in 2023, and that this was the anniversary of the publication of the first folio. Do you believe that Anne was in any way involved with the first folio project or with Shakespeare's legacy after his death?
That's a really good question, Cassidy. I had quite a bit of fun with this when I was researching a book called Shakespeare's Book, which you interviewed me about in a previous episode of that Shakespeare Life, Cassidy, which was a lot of fun. And in that book, which is about the making of the first folio, I speculated about whether or not Anne had something to do with the first folio. So when I was putting that book together, I created a kind of chronology for the printing of the first folio, you know, what was happening and when, in what order. And I superimposed that onto the activities that John Hemmings and Henry Condell were engaged with at that same time. And Hemmings and Condell were Shakespeare's friends and fellow actors in the playing company, The King's Men, but they were also instrumental in creating the first folio. So what was going on in parallel during this period? Well, I noticed something quite intriguing. The first folio printing was paused in the summer of 1622, roughly from around July to October. So what was going on during that pause in the printing of Shakespeare's collected works? Well, that very summer, the King's Men travelled to Stratford-upon-Avon, where they were famously paid not to perform at the local Guildhall. There was a long-standing prohibition against playing at the Guildhall. So the King's Men offered their services, but were asked to sling their hook, basically, and not to perform. So what else were they doing while they were in Stratford-upon-Avon during this break in the printing of the first folio? Were Hemmings and Condell looking for versions of Shakespeare's plays in his native Stratford? Did they consult Anne Shakespeare and her family about the making of the first folio? It's possible. I mean, we know there were plenty of plays to be printed at that point for which good quality copy texts or manuscripts were required. So perhaps they did talk to Anne about the project. They probably visited Shakespeare's grave while they were there, because why wouldn't they want to? You know, Shakespeare was such a close friend and they were memorializing him at the time. It would have been a poignant thing to do at any time, let alone during the period when they're commemorating Shakespeare by printing the first folio and ensuring the continuation of his legacy. So maybe when they were paying their respects to Shakespeare in his native Stratford, they looked upon Shakespeare's monument and saw what the title page of the first folio could be, because the first folio title page and Shakespeare's monument in Stratford-upon-Avon's Holy Trinity Church are kind of similar in a way. There are some synergies between those two. So that's something I noticed, and we will never know if Hemmings and Condell were consulting with Anne, but it's very possible that they, you know, why would you pitch up in Stratford-upon-Avon and not tell Shakespeare's widow about this grand project to memorialise her late husband? The other thing I noticed, which I found really poignant, was another interesting parallel in the to do with the printing of the first folio, but also other events around them. Anne Shakespeare, as Catherine mentioned, died on the 6th of August, 1623. And when I kind of tallied up what was being printed at the time, it was actually Shakespeare's Othello. So we know what was being printed in the printing house when Anne died and was buried. It was Shakespeare's Othello. Interestingly, less than 2 weeks after her death, on the 19th of August, the King's Men relicensed Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale, for performance. Now, the prompt book, that is the performance text for that play, had been reported missing by the company, and it's possible it had been missing for quite some time, and they had done absolutely nothing about that. But then, suddenly, just after Anne's death, they decide to relicense this play. And what happens next, I think, is really interesting. The play is among those performed in the first winter court season after Anne's death. So did the King's Men want to revive the play as a tribute to her? This is a really tantalizing prospect. This play contains a poignant representation of monumentalized motherhood in the character of Hermione, who is believed to be dead and commemorated as a statue, only for that statue to appear to come to life, apparently miraculously resurrecting Hermione. But Hermione and her husband, Leontes, have a son named Mamilius, who died and was not revived at the end of the play. So did Hemmings and Condell know that this play meant something to Anne and William Shakespeare? Did Mamilius represent their son Hamnet? If the King's Men were commemorating Anne through that performance, it also means that Anne was very special to them. She was somebody they cherished. If this is true, then does the fact that this happened so close to the printing of the first folio mean that she was in some way involved with the preservation of Shakespeare's legacy? Perhaps we will never know, but it certainly captures the imagination to speculate about this. And I found it rather moving doing so when I was writing Shakespeare's book.
To share a piece of this collection with us as a sample, Aaron, I wonder if you have one poem that really represents the memorial you've put together for Anne. Do you have one that you think would make a great example that you can read for us?
Yeah, there's one in here by Andrew McMillan, who I think is an absolutely wonderful contemporary poet, one of our finest writers as a poet and novelist. But what I love about it is it talks about the quiet work that Anne did behind the scenes to make William kind of to clear him of his anxieties and to enable him to write. And it's called What I Told Him. So I'm going to read that one by Andrew McMillan. What I Told Him. He came in once with a ditty about the armfuls of fruit he'd foraged for us. And I told him that he was terrible at rhyme. The night of his premiere, I said we couldn't go. There were carols in the park and I wanted us there as a family. Those nights he tossed and turned, racked with worry after writing me into some hemmed up sonnet. I tried to reassure him that no one really reads his poems. No one would stop me in the street. I called him lazy, told him that his work was not the work of men. It was not a proper job. He had no right to be so tired. All of this I said for love. He had so much praise. I saw how much it troubled him. I had to try and save him from the crowded world. He needed to write, and in order to write, he had to believe that nobody was watching.
I think that's a beautiful representation of what her life must have been like living with someone like Shakespeare. What a beautiful example. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
Now that we've explored the life of Anne Hathaway, I know we're motivated to learn more and would relish your recommendations for the best place to begin. Obviously, the first starting point would be the anthology itself. So please tell us where to find that. Then share your recommendations for finding out more about Anne Hathaway and her life in turn of the 17th century England.
Readers can grab the anthology from brokenseatbooks.com, but it's also available in all major bookstores such as Waterstones, Foyles. We have global distribution, so you can get it from Walmart and Target and areas like that on their website as well. We are also like all the major sort of Amazon, all those sort of places. But yeah, and the Shakespeare, if you're ever in Stratford-upon-Avon, please head over to the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, the Anne's Cottage, etc. It's also available there, which is a real source of pride.
I would recommend Lena Orland's amazing book, The Private Life of William Shakespeare. The notes to this book are really a second book full of rich detail, historical research. Jermaine Greer's book, Shakespeare's Wife, is an obvious choice. And The Shakespeare Circle, edited by our own Paul Edmondson and Stanley Wells, is another good source. If I can do a bit of self-promotion, I also wrote a book about Anne and her afterlife called Imagining Shakespeare's Wife. And just a few years ago, Paul and I wrote the entries for Anne and her daughters, Susanna and Judith, for the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. So now they have their own lives as opposed to being subsumed by their famous husband and father. You're no longer directed to Shakespeare's entry to learn more about the women in his life.
Of course, here on That Shakespeare Life, our next question is asked to all of our guests, and we will allow each one of you to make a selection, because this question is, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible. So your choice would be in addition to those.
I think, Cassidy, the last time I was on That Shakespeare Life, I said The Lord of the Rings at this point. But if I didn't, I can say that again. But if I did say that before, then I'll say that I'd take Mansfield Park by Jane Austen with me, which I've just finished. It's my favourite Jane Austen novel. It's a book about stability and about fortitude. And I like to think that both Anne and New Place were anchors for Shakespeare. They were places where he could feel stable and at peace in what I think probably was quite a hectic world in the theatre circles of London. And it's also the novel in which somebody reads Shakespeare aloud. Henry Crawford reads from Henry VIII in Mansfield Park. So that I'll take that one for now.
That's a great question. I would have to say Edmund Spenser's epic poem, The Faerie Queen, which would really require a lot of concentrated time and space. And if I already have Shakespeare there, I might as well tackle another major writer of the period.
It's hilarious because that's also my desert island book. It's that phrase about great minds thinking alike. I'm quite chuffed that we both chose that. Yeah, it's an incredible fantasy epic, The Faerie Queen. Why would you not want to read it? It has witches, mythical beasts. It has an alien from the moon. It has two robots. What's not to like? So that would be my book as well.
We could have the same island.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We can fight over the book if there's only one.
I would pick Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. I collect it. I collect as many versions and copies of it as I can find, because obviously in the 30-odd years after its publication, he revised and expanded and changed it. So I'd probably get the last version rather than the first version. I collect various versions of it, and it's because it's the one book I turn to when I'm in need of inspiration, when I'm in need of soul, when I'm in need of joy, when I'm needed or to be reminded of the brilliance of humanity and the joy of the human soul. After I had a stroke, there was a phrase that I stuck with me, and it was, do I contradict myself? Very well, I contradict myself. I am large, I contain multitudes. And it was that containing multitudes. Stroke survivor was just one multitude of who I was. And I'm actually getting it, that I contain multitudes tattooed on me in March. So I'd go for Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass.
Well, it's nice to have an American be included on the island of famous British writers of this collection. And I think you've all chosen beautiful selections. You'd be well set up on your desert island trip for sure. So what's next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
I'm working on a short book for Oxford University Press called Shakespeare and Stratford-upon-Avon. But what it's enabling me to do is to reimagine what the town was like in Shakespeare's time, his neighbours, where they lived, and revisiting the town's substantial record for that period is really enjoyable. And I mentioned the exhibition at New Place, The Women Who Made Shakespeare. I'm involved in that as well. And Anne features as one of those subjects.
I'm working on a book about the history of women in Stratford-on-Avon, which maybe will be a companion piece to Paul's book. So, and it looks at basically the bones of the town and the roots of women in setting that up. So everything from the gardens at Anne Hathaway's cottage to the cottage itself to Shakespeare's birthplace to the Shakespeare Memorial Theater, all of those spaces are designed and established by women.
I'm currently writing another biography about the enigmatic statesman Sir Robert Cecil, He overcame considerable disabilities and obstacles to become the most powerful man in England during the reigns of Elizabeth I and James I. I'm particularly interested in him because some people believe Shakespeare-based Richard III, his version of Richard III, on Sir Robert Cecil. So I'm doing some digging to find out whether or not that was really the case.
I'm currently been working on a project that has gone to the government where when I came out of hospital after my stroke, there was no mental health care provisions for stroke survivors. So I worked with the National Charity Stroke Association and MIND to create mental health provisions for stroke survivors. I presented it to the Welsh government last week. So I've been working on that, creating these new mental health care provisions, and it's got cross-party support and will be debated and put into a new mental health care remit over the next couple of months. So like I'm on the national news tonight at 6 p.m. and stuff like that. And alongside that, I'm working on a non-fiction book about what it means to survive after you've survived. So like having survived the stroke, what it means to then carry on and survive the aftermath of that. So survival after survival.
There's a mountain of exciting and powerful work coming up soon from this group. And there's so much Shakespeare history here with us in one room. This is so much fun to hear about all of these projects being in the works. If you would like to follow any of these projects, we will place direct links to the resources and information about our guests, including the resources they've shared with you today, all in the show notes for today's episode. So stay tuned for the URL for where to find those. Paul Edmondson, Catherine Scheil, Chris Lau-Torres, and Aaron Kent, thank you so much to all of you for being here to share a piece of the legacy of Anne Hathaway Shakespeare and helping us get to know her that much better. It's been a delight to speak with all of you.
Thank you, Cassidy.
Thanks, Cassidy. Bye.
Thanks so much, Cassidy, and thanks so much to all your listeners and followers for tuning in.
Thank you very much, Cassidy.
As I mentioned earlier, the URL for where to find direct links to our guests, their work, and the resources they've recommended for you to use if you want to explore Anne Hathaway's life further is all packed into our show notes at CassidyCash.com/episode316. That's CassidyCash.com/EP316. While you're on that page, if you would like to see more in-depth history related to today's show, including portraits, woodcuts, links to some of the records and primary documents our guests mentioned today, and even some of the more information on that archaeological dig that happened at New Place, then use the Become a Patron button on our show notes page. This button will allow you to expand all the behind-the-scenes research that went into today's show, along with special extras and visual content that complement our conversation. All of these things are available there for patrons to go along with our episode today. If you're already a patron of our show, you can use that button to log in and expand all the content. Again, that URL is CassidyCash.com/episode316. That Shakespeare Life is made possible by listeners like you who support our work on Patreon. When you support us on Patreon, you get behind-the-scenes content, detailed show notes, and access to over 150 additional episodes of our show not available on public listening platforms. We have tons of special extras packed in there, including educator extras. If you're teaching Shakespeare history, you'll want to check out our Experience Shakespeare tier that offers coordinating classroom resources that coordinate with our show and, of course, with Shakespeare's Place. You can find out more and explore all these bonuses at patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That's patreon.com/thatshakespearelife. That Shakespeare Life is researched and produced by me, Cassidy Cash. Our audio engineer is Gary Mayholm. That's it for this week. Thank you for listening. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learn something new about the Bard. I'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.